Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and 3 times best-selling author here to help you with all things health, fitness, and mindset. This is normally the stage where I would be doing an introduction for a guest, but today's episode is a solo. So it is just me and you talking all things fitness in today's podcast. So things training, nutrition, supplementation, etc. So body composition, fat loss, building muscle, getting fitter, toning up, or just improving performance is your primary goal, then hopefully you get loads from today's episode. As always, in the Q&A, it's also timestamped, so you can jump straight through to the specific question that applies to you, or you can listen through in its entirety, whatever way you like to consume the podcast. So let's jump straight in. First question, Brian, should you feel hungry in a calorie deficit? I'll keep this one quite short because I have touched on this in previous podcasts, particularly in episode 291, the nutrition deep dive, which goes through everything that you need to know, particularly with a fat loss or a weight loss goal when it comes to body composition change. And when it comes to nutrition, how to design your calorie intake, how to adjust your macronutrients, how to choose your food choices, how to add your training in on top of that. So I would definitely recommend listening to that off the back of this podcast. But should you feel hungry in a calorie deficit, first thing I will say here is language is important. Should you is a very subjective term based on what you're following. What I would say is you don't have to feel hungry in a calorie deficit. And the hunger levels are normally feedback on the food choices that you're using. And there's two kind of main thought processes for this that most professionals will have for someone with a fat loss goal. And that is a little bit of an adjustment period when it comes to a drop in calories, meaning that if you've gone from consuming 4,000 or 5,000 calories a day to 2,500 calories a day, sometimes you can have this hunger adjustment period where it takes 7, 10, 14, 21 days to get a little bit of a readjustment from that calorie drop. So that happens with a lot of people. But in my experience and nearly 10 years working with people now, it's normally the food choices that determine this. So if you, it can work in reverse. Sometimes I've had people who have came to me in quite an overweight or obese state to start with, and their food choices were very low nutrient based in the beginning. So they were eating either McDonald's, you know, at least once a day or several times a week, a lot of biscuits, a lot of chocolates, and their calorie intake actually was in that 3,500, 4,000 calorie range. And then sometimes, in most cases, I would drop them to say 2,500 calories, 2,000 calories, depending on where they fell at the spectrum on their weight, their starting point, their height, etc. And it came from nutrient-dense food, so we would swap out the food choices and they actually felt more satiated in that calorie drop. So that can show you that the impact food choices play on your subjective hunger levels throughout the day and actual physiological hunger levels throughout the day. For example, if you're eating a lot of processed foods that's devoid of fiber, you're going to feel hungrier throughout the day. Whereas as soon as you bump up that fiber intake or you start to minimize the lack of micronutrients you're getting from those highly processed foods, i.e. you swap out some processed foods for fruits, vegetables, etc., you'll start filling in those gaps in micronutrients. So you'll have this feeling of higher energy throughout the day. So you'll be able to go from, you know, breakfast to lunch to dinner and feel quite good between those meals. And if you have high quality snacks in between, you're actually still keeping calories quite low, but you're still in that overall deficit. So what I generally recommend people consider when it comes to hunger is it's a 100% subjective thing to you, meaning that one person can go, we can follow two identical plans, for example, me and the person that's sitting in the question, and one of us could be really hungry on the plan and the other one might not be, depending on what our starting point was. So for example, my diet is quite nutrient dense, but if I'm used to eating 3,000 calories a day and I drop it to 2,500 calories per day, I normally have an adjustment period of about a week where I feel quite hungry just because it's a 500 calorie drop. For whatever reason, I'm trying to reduce body fat, or in my case, drop a little bit of weight in the lead up to a race so that I'm lighter on race day. I'm trying to drop calories back. So I haven't gone from poor food to high nutrient dense food. I've gone from good quality food to a calorie drop, meaning that I need that adjustment period. So your starting point matters here and what you're doing matters here. But general rule of thumb is if you feel hungry in a calorie deficit, look at your food choices. Not all foods are created equal. And there are some arguments, and I'm not a calories in, calories out coach. I do think calories play a massive role and are the foundation pyramid of which your nutritional plan is built. But that's not to negate all the other things that you need to consider on top of that. Your food choices play a role, the nutrient density of those foods, the energy levels throughout the day, how you're feeling, etc. But hunger is normally down to what you've chosen as food. And if you're going on a calorie counting plan, one of the main downsides of a calorie counting plan, one that you just go, well, I'm eating and counting calories, is those food choices might not be good. An example of this, and one of my biggest pet peeves in nutrition, is low calorie yogurts, one that's removed the fat from yogurt and have loaded it either with sweeteners or worse, sugar. And its calorie count is lower because there's only 4 kilocalories per gram of carbohydrate, can be from sugar, and there's 9 kilocalories per gram of fat that's in a yogurt, for example. So if they pull out and reduce, to take out the fat or make it zero fat, they're saving on calories even if they bump up the sugar for taste. So although you've now gone with a potentially worse food choice in terms of fat being too low, and some of those fats might have been potentially supportive for you on your plan, to a high sugar, which causes its own problems when it comes to blood sugar spikes, energy level imbalances throughout the day, and just cravings later in the day, you want to be very mindful of the food choices that you're choosing. So should you feel hunger in a calorie deficit, you can, but you definitely don't have to. Brian, what are your thoughts on reverse dieting? Reverse dieting, for anyone unfamiliar with the term, is normally where you start with a number on a calorie intake and then you try and adjust it upwards back to normally maintenance. So for example, if you're a female with a maintenance calories of 2000, to just keep the numbers very simple and straightforward, and you've started to diet on a calorie deficit plan down to say 1500 calories, where you're in that 500 calorie deficit per day, there'll be a point in time when you've changed goals, when you've maybe hit your fat loss target, or you want to adjust your calories upwards because you're trying to hit a secondary goal, etc. Or you've just changed your body composition, so now your maintenance calories has changed. So where it was 2000, you're now considerably lighter, or your body fat is lower and it's actually now at 1900. But let's say, for argument's sake here, it's the same. You've gone from 2000 calories at maintenance to 1500 calorie plan or 1400 calorie plan, and you want to get your calories back up to maintenance so that you can train for a couch to 5K, or you can work on some strength goals, or you can work on a secondary goal. You've hit your fat loss target and now you want to reverse diet up. My thoughts on it are that reverse dieting is a skill, and it's a skill in its truest sense that you don't need to know it and use it all the time, but it's very useful to know when you need to apply it. So it's the same as, you know, swinging a golf club. Like, that's a skill in itself, or learning to swim, or figuring out how to swim with good technique. They're skills that you don't necessarily use every day, assuming you're not a professional golfer or a swimmer, but they're useful to have. And reverse dieting falls into that bracket. Knowing how to do it is important. And this is a whole module in my nutrition course about reverse dieting out, particularly for people who are either struggling with low calorie plans and they're not sure how to bring themselves out of it, or trainers and potential nutritionists who want to help their clients, personal trainers, etc., who want to help their clients come out of this. I have a full module in that course for this. And the basis of it is that you gradually increase people up so you get them back to their end target. So with reverse dieting, normally the amount of time you've been dieting will contribute to how long you'll reverse diet out. So let's say you've been dieting hard for 12 weeks. You've gone from 2000 calories down to 1500 calories or 1400 calories, or in some cases even lower if you've done a really restrictive diet regimen to hit a specific goal for a holiday or a photo shoot or just something you want to look your best for, but you've gone quite extreme with your deficit. Your runway of time on your reverse diet will normally be determined on how long you were dieting in the first place. So general rule of thumb, and this is not a one size fits all, it's more of a best practice to consider, is your normal dieting time, your reverse dieting duration will be half of that time. So if you've been dieting hard for 12 weeks, you probably want to reverse diet out for about 6 weeks. And I actually don't have a problem, for the most part, with people doing extreme calorie deficits for a specific date or for a specific goal. I have a problem with people not having an exit strategy when they do that, because it can lead to a whole host of hormonal problems, downregulation in ghrelin, leptin, hunger, satiation hormones. You can have low energy levels, low sex drive, immune function can get suppressed, so you get sick all the time. So not having an exit strategy when you do an extreme calorie deficit, I think, is a problem. But I think it's dependent on the person. I personally, with rare exceptions of people in my program, don't do extreme calorie programs. I don't drop them down to 1200 calories unless they're, you know, 5'4", 50 kilogram girl, then maybe in that case. But for the majority, very rarely will I drop anyone below 1600 calories, particularly if we're trying to build good habits in a place with the program that has exercise and movement in there. So whether it's a step count every day, or whether it's HIIT programs at home, or whether it's gym-based or home-based weight workouts or resistance training, you're trying to build those good habits in place. Or in my program, I'm trying to build those good habits in place with people. So as a result, dropping calories too low doesn't facilitate that. So it's not something I generally do. But reverse dieting is something you can largely do yourself. And a good protocol, and as I said, I don't want to give a one-size-fits-all answer to something that's quite nuanced based on the individual, but if you were giving yourself a six-week period to reverse out and you're at, you know, 1400 calories now and you want to get back up to 2000 calories, I would give yourself that six-week period and maybe an increase in, you know, 200 calories every 2 weeks until you get back to maintenance. So it might look like week one and two, you're at 1400 calories, or week one and two, you're at 1600 calories. Then week three and four, you're at 1800 calories, a further increase of 200. And then week five and six, you're back up to your maintenance of 2000. And again, your time period, the jump in calorie intake, all of that will be determined on your starting point, how long you've been dieting, what you've been doing, etc. Where you get those calories from largely determines or is dependent on what do you prefer and what can you stick to and what your secondary goal is. For if it's somebody that's going from a, you know, a body composition fat loss program to a strength phase, I'd probably get the calorie increase from carbohydrate and fuel those workouts. But again, they're all tactics within a strategy of reverse dieting up so that you're not getting this rebound and you're not getting this negative impact on hormones that I mentioned, and you're not getting all the body composition downsides of cutting calories too drastically and going too low, meaning that when people hit their fat loss goal and they've restricted calories to 1300, 1400, 1500, whatever the number is, and then they've hit their goal, you can have a little bit of a, okay, what now moment. And that normally leads to people kind of falling off the bandwagon, potentially pressing the fuck it button with their diet and self-sabotaging, and then bringing themselves back up where their weight and fat levels are actually higher than they were when they started. And that's something you're trying to avoid. And reverse dieting and having the skill of how to do that can be a tool that you use that stops that happening. So when I think of reverse dieting, it's a tool that you can use. And if you use it effectively, it's something that can minimize any downsides or negative effects of any calorie restriction plan, but particularly an extremely caloric restricted plan. Question three, Brian, can you build muscle in a calorie deficit? I'll keep this one quite short because I've covered it quite a bit on previous podcasts, but it has been coming up a lot recently, either through Instagram DM or people that I've been working with in upcoming BKF online programs and just kind of in my space in general for anywhere I put question boxes for Q&As. The answer here is yes, it's just considerably harder. The advantage of building muscle in a calorie surplus plan, so a calorie surplus is just anything above your maintenance. So let's say, for example, to keep the analogy of, or keep the example of earlier, your calories are 2000 calories per day for your maintenance. Any number below that is a calorie deficit. Any number above that is a calorie surplus, just for to keep it simple for the example here. Building muscle in a calorie deficit just becomes considerably harder because your body is trying to hit multiple goals. So if you're in a calorie deficit, automatically I'm assuming that you have some form of fat loss goal or some form of weight loss goal that you're trying to achieve. And building muscle alongside a fat loss goal is far from impossible. It's just harder because you're trying to hit multiple goals. And it's the same as anything. If you try and hit two goals at the same time, you get a little bit of jack of all trades, master of none approach if you don't approach it the correct way. And I've had answered similar questions when people say, you know, I want to build muscle and I want to run a marathon. I'm like, you can also do that. It's just harder because your calorie burnt from your running program can be a lot and can offset some of the calories you're consuming that you probably and potentially would use to build muscle, otherwise all other things considered and all other things equal. And building muscle in a calorie deficit plan can be similar. You're trying to hit two goals. You're trying to bring down body fat. But as a result of calories being too low, you might not be getting exactly what you need to build muscle. And building muscle is a lot more complicated of a process than losing fat. fat loss is actually a very straightforward process. Its application can be tricky for people because of behavioral issues around food, the mindset and approach, etc., the strategy that you take. But the process is actually very straightforward. For 99 out of 100 people, with the exception of those with a hormonal imbalance and some underlying issue, 99 out of 100 people will lose fat if they're in a calorie deficit, meaning that you're consuming less calories than your body needs so that you can tap into stored fat for fuel. There's a whole host of secondary effects that will play a role with that: your training program, your moving, your metabolism, and what you're doing to support that. So resistance training to increase your metabolic rate so you burn more calories. All these things can support a fat loss goal, but paring it down to its most basic form, if you're in a deficit where you're able to tap into stored fat and use it for fuel, you will lose fat and reduce body fat over time. Building muscle then is different, because training plays a much more pivotal role when it comes to building lean muscle tissue. And a misconception some people have with the gym in particular is people think, well, I build muscle in the gym. I'm like, you don't build muscle in the gym. You actually do the complete opposite in the gym. You tear your body down, and you're breaking your body down in the gym. Your nutrition, your recovery, your sleep, they're the things that build the muscle. So when you're in the gym, you're actually in breakdown mode. You're breaking your body down. You're tearing muscle fibers down, and you're breaking it down so that when you eat your amino acids from your protein and you get enough calories in and you sleep well and you have a recovery protocol in place, you can grow back, and that muscle will either get bigger or that muscle will get stronger, or a combination of both. So when you're in a calorie deficit, the disadvantage of that is you don't get what are called macro sparing, the protein sparing macronutrient benefit of fat and carbohydrate. So when you are eating a lot of calories, so let's say 2000 calories, as I mentioned, is the maintenance. If you're eating 3000 calories per day and you have a muscle building goal, you don't need as much protein as you think generally, because what will happen with those amino acids that you are consuming, your body will use those and prioritize those for repair from your workouts, meaning you'll be able to build back that muscle, repair that muscle so it gets bigger and stronger. And it does this very efficiently if your carbohydrate and or fat source are high enough that you can use those for other jobs, i.e. energy throughout the day, etc. So they become macro protein sparing macronutrients. So you end up using those for energy, and your body can prioritize the protein that it uses for repair. Again, I'm simplifying a very complicated process here, but this is effectively how it works. And when you're in a deficit, generally, you will have a fat or a carbohydrate or both reduced in your plan in order to keep those calories down. And with that, now the protein that you're using can potentially be used for energy throughout the day. A mistake a lot of people make, and I actually made this in the early days of my training, probably in my early 20s, was where I would drop carbohydrates so low and my fats were quite naturally low. I was originally of that bodybuilding era of, you know, fats are low, you know, get your carbohydrates as you need them, but drop them when you're cutting and up your protein. And what happens when you make that mistake is your body just ends up converting the protein and the amino acids you're eating and uses it for energy. It's a process called gluconeogenesis. It's where the amino acids from the protein get broken down, converted back to glucose, and you use that for fuel, which isn't what you want it to do, because it's actually a very inferior fuel source compared to fat or fatty acids that you're consuming from fat, or carbohydrates that you can either potentially use for glucose or store glycogen, which will eventually convert to glucose for energy. So it's a very poor source of energy. But a lot of people make this mistake where their protein is way too high and they end up dropping back their carbohydrates and dropping back their fats. So with building muscle in a calorie deficit, you need to have your training program that has enough resistance training that can facilitate breaking your body down, but not too much, which is, again, can be complicated, and it can be a how long is a piece of string question, depending on your starting point, your starting weight, the amount of muscle you currently have, etc. But you want a training program in alignment with creating some form of resistance on your body. Also, if you're trying to lose fat, you're probably going to look at something like high intensity interval training as your cardio source, something that works as muscle preservation, but also can be a good calorie burner to support that calorie deficit, versus hours or 45 minutes or hours of steady state cardio, where you're running a lot or you're on the cross trainer for an hour and a half. They're not as supportive, although, again, you can make arguments depending on the calorie intake, etc. But generally, high intensity interval training normally wins out if you're looking at a combination of anecdotal evidence from myself and clients I've worked with, but also from the research and the studies. You're looking at high intensity interval training as the primary source. So that's your training element. With your nutrition, then, you're looking at minimally hitting your daily protein requirements, whatever that is. And again, these numbers vary and they range from, you know, 1 to 2 grams per kilogram to 1 pound of body weight, all the way up to, you know, higher on that spectrum depending on the program. So it depends, and it's a little bit of individual context on the person, and professional nutritionists will have different variations of the number that they like to include based on how they've split up the plan with the fats and carbohydrates. And then you're obviously hitting your fat and carbohydrate intake throughout the day. That's going to support that training, so you can utilize that for energy. So as you can probably gather from my answer, it's not a straightforward process. When you're trying to build muscle, it's a lot more straightforward than trying to build muscle and lose body fat. It's the same as when you're trying to lose body fat, it's a lot more straightforward to do that than try and build muscle with it. But you can do both of these goals. It just means you need a training program and a nutritional plan and potentially some supplements that support that, that will work towards those multiple goals that you're trying to hit. So it's not that it can't be done, it's just a lot more complicated. But if you have the discipline, if you have the persistence, if you have the patience to either do it yourself or work with an individual or a coach or a professional who can do that, you can 100% do both. Question 4, Brian, I'm using my FitnessPal app. Do you eat back your calories burned for fat loss? This is definitely up there with one of my biggest frustrations when it comes to fitness technologies, because of the frustration that it causes people and the confusion that causes people. So there is a whole area, I've talked about this in the last book, The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss, when it comes to fitness technology. I think MyFitnessPal falls into this bracket, and I'm a big fan of MyFitnessPal. It's normally the recommendation that I offer in my Be Careful Online program. I've actually got 3 options of programs. 1, when you sign up, you can follow the nutritional plan exactly as is. 2, you can mix and match it with different recipes, and I work with you on that. And then 3, I give you the calories and macros if you want to do your own food choices. There's 3 options, and normally 99 out of 100 people that I work with, one of those 3 options tends to work well to kind of get them up and running. And with MyFitnessPal, I'm a big fan. It gives you direct feedback on, or within a ballpark feedback on, the calories you're consuming, macros you're consuming. Now, there's always some room for error with all of these apps, so I wouldn't take them for gospel and I wouldn't take them exactly as is. But within that 80, 90%, they're more or less accurate. But with the calorie deficit fat loss plan, this can frustrate people, because they end up eating back the calories they've lost. And this is very prominent with people who use fitness watches. Also, I'm a big fan of fitness watches, Garmin's or any Fitbit or any smartwatch. I'm a big fan. Apple Watch, they do work, and they're very useful for a whole host of things when it comes to fitness and just tracking it in general. But one thing that they're not accurate for, and people put a lot of emphasis on, is the amount of calories burnt during sessions. And this in and of itself is going to sound so obvious when I say it to you, but it's one of those duh moments when somebody from a professional standpoint points it out. And that is that if you're following an app or you're tracking it through a fitness technology on a watch or anything on your phone, and it's not accurate, you can very easily overconsume calories, which won't support a fat loss goal. So if you have a fat loss goal, you need to be in a calorie deficit over time. So how you do this, whether it's a space of several days, several months, etc., how you design it, as long as you're within an overall calorie deficit. Something I talk about in The Keen Edge is you don't have to be in a deficit every single day. You just have to be in a deficit overall. So whether you space that over 7 days, 14 days, 21 days, you can cycle your calories, meaning that they're higher at weekends, but they're lower during the week, to end up for a 7-day deficit at the end of the week. You can design it that way. And where people get frustrated and confused is if they're following an app or they're following a fitness technology that says, well, you've done an hour workout, you burned 400 calories in that workout. And you might not have burned 400 calories in that workout. You might have burned 200 calories in that workout. And as a result, you think, well, actually, I can eat back some of those calories. But if you only burned 200 and you ate back 400 and that didn't support your deficit, you can either plateau or have weight gain or fat gain at the end of the week. And this can add up and compound positively over time. And something I will get people to do when I'm working with them in my programs is, one, they're not allowed to track calories burnt on watches because they're not accurate. And that in and of itself will support you a little bit. But what I'd say here with eating calories back, you'll know based on how your body is physically responding. So if you're using correct tracking metrics and not just a weighing scale, which I think in and of itself is fine, but it can't be your only tool that you're using. It's like going to war with, you know, a knife. It's better than nothing, but you probably need a gun and you probably need a sniper rifle and you probably need a grenade launcher, and all of those things will help you more. And that's effectively how tracking your fat loss progress is. Weight loss is a tool and a single thing you can use, but it's not the only thing you should be using. When you're tracking fat loss, you want to use photos. I'm a big, big fan of photos. Photos won't lie with a body composition goal. If you're trying to lose body fat, if you're trying to tone up, if you're trying to build muscle, you will see it in photos if you're tracking it correctly over time with the same conditions, same lighting, same time of day each week. Also, measurements can be really useful. So if you have a measuring tape, tracking your measurements through your main parts, so your hips, your chest, your arms, your legs, etc. And then clothing. Again, a bit more of a subjective one, but how is your clothing feeling? How do you look in those clothes? Did your jean size drop? Did you drop a dress size? All of these things can be indicators of fat loss reduction in the plan that you're following. And with something like MyFitnessPal, if you're eating back those calories and you're not losing fat, it means you're eating back too many calories. You have direct feedback on there. That failure is feedback. And you have direct feedback that actually your calories are still too high. And fat loss, as straightforward as it is, and I mentioned this earlier, it's a very straightforward process. You need to be in a calorie deficit over time to tap into stored fat and use it for fuel. But there is an element of testing with that. And you might be over consuming calories either because of inaccuracies in tracking, which can happen with people, or what I call nearly secret eating tendencies, where you end up tracking some food and not tracking other food. I call it in the Keen Edge, the last book, The Seven Deadly Diet Sins, that you don't track everything you eat, meaning that people will track their breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but they won't track the biscuits they had and snacked on throughout the day or the bits they were picking at throughout the day. And when you remove the subjective or emotional attachment to the thing you're using to track, you'll have better success with it. And I tell people, look, if you're doing tracking, which is a tool, and I use it for some people and I don't for others, if you're using tracking as a tool, such as MyFitnessPal, track everything. Be diligent with it. If you've eaten 5 Mars bars after lunch, track it, because at least you've got feedback then that, well, actually my fat won't come down this week because my calories are too high. Then you can realign those expectations and you can adjust that so that you're not feeling depleted and down at the end of the week because you didn't hit your goal. Or you can be a little bit more restrictive the leading days because, you know, I've got calories to spare. I'm actually not going to be as hungry, or I can burn through some of those calories because I, you know, overate on Monday and Tuesday, and I'll probably be okay dropping them by an extra couple of hundred on Tuesday and Wednesday. It's, again, assuming there's no poor relationship with food. You don't want to reinforce any negative behavior patterns when it comes to food behavior. I'm talking 100% healthy food relationship individual who has a fat loss goal and who's not fooding themselves because of that. So as I said, a lot of nuances and a lot of things to consider. But with MyFitnessPal and with any fitness technology, eating your calories back can be something that leads to frustration and confusion with people, because you'll wonder at the end of the week, well, why is my fat level still up, or why is it the same? And you might just be eating back too many calories. This is very common with those fitness apps, as I said, because they're very inaccurate. The same as when you're on a cardio machine in the gym and it says you burned 500 calories or 600 calories. They are so inaccurate, it's not even funny. And it's just a case of removing yourself from those. Look at it if you want to give you an idea of, you know, how intense you've worked out. And if you burn 600 calories today and you did 700 calories tomorrow, well, you considerably more intense in that 700 calorie session. So you can use it as a scale for how intense you went, but don't use it as feedback for how many calories you burnt. Your metabolism is so and much more complex than a machine that doesn't have all your details, your lean muscle tissue, your current muscle mass, your current metabolic rate, your genetic history, your physiology. All those things aren't connected to your app. They're not connected to your watch. They're not connected to the gym machine. So without that, there's no way they can be accurate. So unless you're in a laboratory setting and you've got a whole host of researchers around you who have you hooked up to several different machines that are testing everything I've mentioned, I would take it all with a pinch of salt, and at least it won't lead to frustration and confusion when it comes to a fat loss goal. Question 5, is getting fit while building muscle possible, or should one be a priority? Firstly, getting fit is a very subjective term. It's a little bit of a loaded term because it means different things to different people. So for example, if you ask, you know, what my version of fit is, it's when I'm able to run 10 to 20 kilometers without stopping and without feeling super out of breath. Whereas to somebody else, that is like the high pinnacle level of endurance for them. So this is a super subjective term, meaning that if you ask 100 different people, you'll probably get near 100 different answers on what getting fit actually means. So firstly, I'd anchor with that. with building muscle, and I think a better way to take this question is the multiple goal approach, similar to what I talked about earlier about building muscle in a calorie deficit. And I think this stacks nicely on top of it. When you're trying to hit multiple goals, you can sometimes find that it's more difficult because you're not tunnel vision on one. And to get fit, and in this case, let's say, for example, to get fit is to build up your aerobic capacity so that you can comfortably run 3 to 5 kilometers. Let's just say that's the subjective view that we've given for getting fit and what that means and that interpretation of that means for the context of this question. That means that everything you're doing to try and get fit for a 5K is coming at the cost potentially of building muscle and vice versa. So those two goals, although can be seen as pulling from different directions, in the correct program design can actually work quite well together. I actually work with quite a lot of people who have a goal of getting fitter or trying to bring up their basic fitness for cycling or running or swimming or whatever it is, but also have a body composition goal, either to lose fat or build muscle. So this is all in your program design. So if you have a goal of, you know, running a 5 kilometer race or just 5 kilometers somewhat comfortably and a muscle building goal, you'll have a structured training program that's designed around that. A 3 to 5 day split, probably somewhere in that 4 to 5 day split more accurately because you're trying to hit those two goals. You'll probably have resistance training in there with the compound multi-joint movements that I talked about earlier, squats, deadlift, bench press, etc. But you also have a phased running program. So you're building up to what will be a 0 to 1 kilometer plan. So your first goal will be, how do I get to a kilometer running at a comfortable pace? And then you'll go to 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers, 5 kilometers over the space of several weeks or several months, depending on your starting point. Same with building muscle. You'll have that training program that has that resistance element in there that can help you build muscle, like I talked about earlier. Then your nutrition will play a big role to recover from that. So not only do you need to recover from those runs, which might, you know, if you're using carbohydrate as your main fuel source, it might have a focus on carbohydrate there to replenish glycogen. You can go two ways with this. You can also be quite a fat adapted, metabolically flexible runner. But with a muscle building goal, I'd be more inclined to go with carbohydrates on the side. You're going to have your carbohydrate intake designed around recovering from those sessions, those runs, those muscle building workouts, etc. And you're also going to be trying to hit those protein requirements, minimal daily protein requirements, so that you can give your body those amino acids it needs to repair so that you can build that muscle. So what I'd say here is you can definitely do both. It depends on your skill set and potentially what you're willing to invest, either time-wise or money-wise, to figure out how to do it yourself or to cut the learning curve and work with a professional or work with a coach. And I don't necessarily think either is right or wrong. It depends on your individual circumstance. I think if you're someone who doesn't have a lot of money but has quite a lot of time, you can get a lot of free content out there. This podcast, for example, other podcasts, books that you can download for free, blog posts, social media. You can educate yourself on, well, how do I get fitter and how do I build muscle at the same time? And then you apply that in your own training program, nutritional plan, etc. Or if you fall on the other end of the spectrum where either patience is an issue or time is an issue, then you work with a professional, you work with a coach who will do this for you. They'll design that plan and make the adaptions for you so you can work towards it. So it's just a case of where do you fall on the spectrum in terms of what you want to achieve, the timeline, and your own individual context and circumstance. With goals, I think it's always useful to have some secondary goals. I'm 100% biased here as somebody that gets bored if I'm doing the same fitness routine over and over again, hence why you might see a CrossFit workout on my Instagram page one week. You might see me running 20 kilometers another week. You might see me doing a bodybuilding workout or a strength and conditioning workout another week or a kettlebell workout or a bodyweight hit because I get bored if I'm doing the same things over and over again. So I like to mix it up. And that's what works quite well for me. But with getting fit and building muscle, the same as any goal, if you pick one, you're going to be able to prioritize that goal. And there's a good chance you'll either hit it faster or in a more efficient way than if you're trying to hit multiple goals or two goals at the same time. It really comes down to self-awareness here and what you want to do. I have spoken about my own example on the podcast in the past. When I was training for my first 100-mile ultramarathon in 2020, when I ran the Jackpot 100 in Nevada right before the COVID lockdown, I wanted to try and run that race. I obviously wanted to try and finish that race in a 24-hour period. Now, it took me a little bit longer. It took me 26 and a half hours. But I also didn't want to lose too much of my shape and size. And I didn't want to break my body down. And I didn't want to put in the countless hours of training that would push me to run it 2 hours faster. So if I was to go back and do it again, something that I've contemplated because I would like to do a 100-mile race at some point and maybe crack 24 hours. But also, there's a cost for trying to hit a multiple goal or hit several goals. So in my case, I didn't want to train and disrupt my family life. I didn't want to train multiple hours a day and disrupt my business because I was too tired to think, to record podcasts, to do interviews, etc. So there was a sticking point or a sweet spot, apologies, that I could do 90-minute sessions, maybe two-hour sessions a day, 4 to 5 times a week. But once I went over that, I started to get a bit brain dead, or I was too tired to be present with my daughter or my partner, or I was just wasn't sleeping well because of the elevated cortisol, which was having negative impacts on my health or my gut or just how I was feeling. So I found this kind of sweet spot, but that also meant that I wasn't able to train as hard to potentially crack that 24-hour mark that I had for myself. So I know if I was to go back again, would I take that payoff? And sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes you're not willing to make the trade-off. Whereas I know myself for a fact, and I've spoken on this in previous podcasts, when I was training for those races, Marathon de Saab, running through the Arctic, 100-mile ultra marathon, and any endurance event I've done, if I went 100% into endurance and just did a minimum effective dose on my strength and conditioning, I would run the races faster. But my goal isn't to finish top three in a race. It's to finish these races, and generally within the time I've set for myself based on what I think I can achieve. And as a result, then, I'm hitting these multiple goals, trying to keep my size, a little bit of muscle, trying to keep my energy levels high, trying to not have it impact my personal life, romantic, family life, etc. Just the way I show up at work and interviewing people. So I'm taking that cost and taking that trade-off. And you probably have to ask yourself the same. If you're trying to build muscle and get fitter and you're trying to hit these multiple goals, do you really want to hit those multiple goals, or do you want to just focus tunnel vision on one so that you can make sure that that's something you 100% do within the specific time frame? And if you're going tunnel vision towards one goal, you're going to be more likely to hit it. If you're trying to hit multiple goals, you could probably still hit both. It just means that you probably won't be amazing or fantastic or brilliant at either. And there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you've made peace with it and you've taken a wider perspective view on, well, actually, I want to get fitter or I want to build muscle, then it's really up to you what you want to do. Or you design a program that combines it. You look at muscle building parameters within a circuit-based workout, you know, 8 to 10 reps, 3 to 4 sets, etc. But you do them within a circuit. So you're getting that fitness level up because of the reduced rest period. You're tearing muscle fibers down to build that muscle. This is where kind of CrossFit workouts can be useful for some people, depending on their genetic starting point. So you can do both. It just depends on the program design. But probably more importantly, asking yourself the question, are you willing to put in the effort to do both? Do you really want to hit these multiple goals at a high level, or where's your sweet spot? And then determine what it is you want to do from there. Question 6. Brian, how do you think the long-term studies of the zero-calorie energy drinks will look from a health perspective? I'll keep this one quite short because I'm always wary of using anecdotal evidence and my opinion as opposed to anything that's backed scientifically. But based on what we know now about zero-calorie drinks, particularly zero-calorie energy drinks as well, Monsters, but even diet drinks fall into this category. The only thing we can categorically say in 2022 is that those drinks would probably have a negative impact on your gut microbiome. That's the only thing that's been hard science proven at the minute, that if you have an issue with your stomach, if you have an issue with your gut microbiome, those drinks probably don't support that. Outside of it, it's conjecture, it's opinion. And this falls for my opinion, this falls for anybody else that says you should or shouldn't have diet drinks or you should or shouldn't have any zero calorie drinks. We're kind of projecting our own opinion on it. Now, I can pull at the thread of the gut microbiome because of my own either knowledge mixed in with conversations I've had on this podcast with the likes of Dr. Megan Rossi, Orla Walsh, dietitian, etc., that if you don't look after your gut microbiome, you're going to give yourself a little bit of a handicap on any secondary goal you have, whether that's physical, trying to lose body fat or build muscle, whether that's performance-based, or whether that's just mental health-based because of the amount of serotonin and mental health links and connections there are between your gut and the way that you feel and your mood. So my opinion tells me that as we get clearer on anything that does damage to our gut microbiome and how that branches out and is effectively interconnected with everything else that we think within health and fitness, we'll probably be a little bit more mindful of how much of them we consume. But again, I'm only offering my opinion here, because if we're using research, which is really all we can at this point, I can only tell you that it has a negative impact on the gut microbiome. I think zero calorie drinks probably come in a context dependent answer when it comes to whether you should use them or not. Some people will use zero calorie drinks, either energy drinks or, you know, diet drinks, as a way to satiate and sustain themselves on a low-calorie plan by giving themselves something that's tasty. Some individuals, as a result of that microbiome issue that I've spoken about, can get severe or quite intense cravings several hours later. So that is something you need to check in with. But there's also a percentage of people who don't have that. And they will literally swear that a can of Diet Coke or a can of Diet 7-Up or a can of Diet whatever, zero-calorie drink, is the thing that keeps them on plan with the fat loss goal. Then I would say it's probably decent in that context. The same as if you're comparing a zero-calorie energy drink to something like water, it's probably not going to be as good. But if you're comparing it to, you know, a vodka and Coke, it's going to be considerably better. So context is dependent here and what you're comparing it to. And as I said, I don't want to spend too much time on this one because it's an opinion. If you ask me this in 6 months' time, 12 months' time, 18 months' time, and there's more research on the topic, I'll probably have a different answer. So I can only offer where my perspective is currently in August of 2022. Question 7, how often should I attempt to up my weight in the gym for all exercises? I get this question at least once on every BKF online program. And it's a really good question because the answer varies slightly depending on the movements you're talking about and also depending on your starting point. So there's two approaches that I would consider here when it comes to increasing weight in the gym for the exercises. One is where you are on your fitness journey, meaning that somebody who's at the very start of their journey, this is their first program, is going to see a considerable strength increase compared to somebody who's been training for 10 years where the progress is minimal and although significant and relatively higher, is still minimal, meaning that somebody who started squatting the bar because it's their first program could see a jump by 200, 300, 400, 500% in weight over several months, where someone who's been training for 10 years might see a small increase, but they're already starting at, you know, 100 kilogram squat, for example. So they might go to 102 or 105, which is still a considerable increase depending on that starting point. So strength increases and upping the weight will be determined on your starting point for one. Somebody who's at the start of their journey will see this jump week on week, every second week or every month, whereas somebody who's been training for 10 years won't see it as dramatic. The second thing to consider then is the movement that you're actually speaking about. So you will find, as a general rule of thumb, compound lifts, multi-joint movements will have a need for an increased weight to fail at a given rep range faster or in a shorter period of time than isolated single joint movements. So if we use a squat or a deadlift as an example of a multi-joint compound lift, because you're recruiting several muscle groups, a squat recruits nearly everything in your body, maybe the exception of your chest. You've got your glutes, hamstrings, quads, lower back, arms and shoulders to a degree in terms of the upright of the movement and the top position of the move. So you have nearly every muscle in your body being worked on a deadlift, assuming you're performing it correctly. Again, high risk reward movement, but performed correctly, it's an incredible movement. With the deadlift, you're going to see a strength increase faster than something like a bicep curl or a side lateral raise where you're hitting your side delt and your shoulder, because they're small muscle groups. And if you're targeting a strength increase with squats and deadlifts, you can probably set the bar a lot higher than those single joint movements like I spoke about. For example, when I do a strength phase, see quite a big jump in my squat or my deadlift or even my bench press. If I'm doing a focused strength phase, I can go from comfortably, you know, pressing 100 kilos on a bench press for several reps to going to, you know, 120, 130 for several reps, because I'm focusing on that in my training. I also have tiny little T-Rex arms, so I'm built to bench press. But again, that's neither here nor there, but just to give you an idea. Whereas my bicep curl, I've been lifting the same weight for probably about 6 years. It's still 12 and a half kilos to 14 kilos for 8 to 10 reps. I can't go any higher than that without breaking form, just because the movement is probably maxed out at capacity in terms of what I can lift without breaking form. And when it comes to increasing weight, this is goal dependent on the plan. a strength program, which is something I don't specialize in. I don't do strength specific programs. I have strength elements within my programs, particularly my GA Lean Body program, my second phase of that program. But I don't do strength programs, powerlifting programs. That's not my area. There's better people out there who will design programs for you based on that goal. But in a powerlifting or a pure strength based program, you would have very tangible numbers you're working towards. If you're starting at, you know, 70 kilos on a deadlift, there's a good chance you have 90 or 100 kilos plus maybe as your end target. Now, whether that's 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years that you're working towards that number on a strength program. In a body composition plan, and the advice I offer people is dependent on what I specialize in. I specialize in body composition, building muscle, toning up, losing body fat, on top of, you know, mindfulness around food and healthy food relationships, etc. But just from the training standpoint I'm talking about here. So what I will advise people to do is we work within rep ranges in my program. So if you are focusing on body composition and say you've got a bench press or a glute bridge, depending on gender and priorities of goals, and you're working for 8 to 10 reps, I normally give 2 rep ranges within the program. You are looking for a weight that you're failing within that rep range, so 8 to 10 reps. So that might be 50 kilos on a bench press, it might be 50 kilos on a glute bridge. And the reason this is so effective for body composition is the weight matters less depending on the day. Because if you go into the gym someday and you feel a bit tired, you had a bit of a stressful day, you didn't sleep that well, you're going to go in and work for that 8 to 10 reps, but you might not be able to lift your 50 kilos on a bench press, or you might not be able to lift your 50 kilos on a glute bridge, but you won't be far off it. You'll be within that 47.5 or that 45 kilograms. You'll still be failing at that 8 to 10 reps, and you'll just be adjusting it downwards. Contrary to that, you've had a great night's sleep, you've had a cup of coffee right before you came in, you feel amazing, and you might go from 50 kilos on your bench press or glute bridge to 52 kilos or 55 kilos, and you're still working within those 8 to 10 reps. So you're working within a rep range and you're not focusing necessarily on the weight, although you can track the weight, you're trying to fail at 8 to 10 reps. So if you've gone in and you've done a weight for a bench press or a glute bridge and you could have done 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 reps, that weight is too light and you need to increase it. Contrary to that, if you go in and you fail at 5 reps or 6 reps, the weight is too heavy and you need to reduce it. So I get people to work towards rep range because of a body composition goal. So again, it depends here. So when it comes to when you should increase your weight on the exercises, look at your starting point. Where are you on your training journey in terms of how many years you've been doing this, how many programs you've been following? What exercises are you specifically talking about? Compound lifts versus single joint movements, you know, your squat and deadlift versus a side lateral raise in a bicep or a barbell curl on a bicep. Or look at your programming and your primary goal. If it's a strength goal, you'll probably have a very tangible number you're working towards. Whereas if you have a body composition goal, you're going to be working within a rep range instead. Question 8. Brian, what's a good resistance training program to get me going? I'm at the 0 to 1 stage. You can find, and I'll link it actually in the description for today's podcast, but you can go on to briankeefitness.com. The training program from my first book, The Fitness Mindset, is available for free on the website, briankeefitness.com. You can download it for free, and all the videos that come alongside that workout and how to perform the moves are also available from briankeefitness.com. So that's quite a beginner-based program. It's a push-pull leg 3-day split. Again, there's obviously going to be more advanced programs, but if you're at the very start and beginning stage and you're looking for a resistance program that hits everything, go over to briankeefitness.com and you can download that and you can get it for free. You don't even need to buy the book. You don't need to download the Fitness Mindset. You don't need to do any of that. You can head straight over there and it'll give you a program. It's got your sets, your reps, your exercises, and your videos that show you how to do those exercises. So if that's something you're struggling with, head over there and you can check that out. And the final question, Brian, is cardio a waste of time? I did a podcast probably about 2 years ago now. I think it was in 2020 with John Jaquish, Dr. John Jaquish, a very controversial podcast where his belief system is that weight training and cardio are a waste of time. And I did a short podcast off the back of that episode, which I quite enjoyed that conversation, but it's one that don't read the title, listen to the episode so you can at least get context on the bounce back and forth and some of the counter arguments that I put to Dr. Jaquish. But I also did a short episode off the back of that, just explaining kind of my interpretation of what we talked about in that episode. And I think cardio being a waste of time, similar to most things, which can be frustrating, but I will give context to my answer, it's subjective. It depends. Cardio is an absolute waste of time if you have a fat loss goal and you're eating too many calories, in my opinion. You might get some secondary benefits psychologically, but feel better. You probably do a little bit of damage limitation when it comes to weight gain. You might like the routine and the element of it and the aerobic benefit that comes from it. But if you're talking about something being a waste of time, you first need to determine what's the goal and what's the thing you're looking to achieve. Because a waste of time is dependent on, well, what are you looking to do? So for example, if you have a fat loss goal and your goal is 100% on fat loss and you're spending endless hours on a cross trainer and your calories are just too high, in my view, subjectively, it's a waste of time doing it, meaning that you're not actually getting any closer to your end goal because you're focusing your attention in the wrong area. And I think this is where cardio and the question of whether cardio is a good use of your time or a waste of time comes into play. In most things with fitness, and I think this applies to life as well, definitely, you know, your mindset and your business and your personal life. But if the thing you're doing now isn't supporting you with your end goal, then it probably is a waste of time. In my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, I talked about, you know, getting clear on what you should be saying yes to and getting clear on what you should be saying no to, and that it needs to be a hell yeah or it's an automatic no. And cardio falls into this bracket, and what you do in your training falls into this bracket because of the attention and the focus that you can give something and the amount of mental real estate that can take. I could also make a compelling argument here that the people you spend time with in your personal, romantic and business relationships all apply here too. But to keep it in a fitness context, cardio is only a waste of time if it doesn't help and elicit the end response that you want. But if it does, it can be a very useful tool. And I think cardio, particularly with the fat loss goal, is a tool. And like most tools, whether you should use it or not depends on your individual circumstance. And it's not the tool that's the problem. If I use an example of a hammer, like a hammer is a tool, but you know, you can use that tool to hammer in a picture in the wall, or you can hit yourself in the dick or in the boob with it. Like it's the tool isn't the problem, it's how you're using it. And cardio falls into this bracket as well. If you are using cardio to help you burn more calories to facilitate a fat loss goal, it's actually really useful. There's also a little bit of a misconception here that, again, apologies for those who've heard me say this before, but some people will say, well, cardio works for fat loss, or cardio helps burn fat. Cardio doesn't help burn fat. Cardio burns calories, and burning more calories can support a deficit, which can help you burn more fat. So I think that's important, because some people will add in cardio thinking, well, I need to lose fat, I need to do cardio. And the reason I anchor it and say it that way is, if you're burning and consuming too many calories and not burning enough calories, then it's actually not supporting you burning body fat, because you're not going to just do cardio and melt fat away. All it's doing is burning calories, and that calories can support that deficit, which can help you reduce your body fat levels. So with cardio, first I would ask, well, is it supporting you? Is what you're doing now based on your goal helping? For example, all cardio isn't created equal either, so I will break that down separately. But if it's helping you with your calorie deficit for a fat loss goal, then it's not a waste of time. It's actually a very supportive use of time. Also, what are you comparing it to? Similar to what I talked about earlier with nutrition, everything is in comparison to what else you could be using, the opportunity cost of that food you're eating or that training program you're following. So opportunity cost is an economics term for, you know, if you spend a euro on a packet of crisps, you can't spend that same euro on a drink. There's an opportunity cost to what you spend it on. And your training and your nutrition is similar. So it's not that cardio is the problem. It's what else could you be doing within that time that could be yielding you either better or more efficient results. And if you have a fat loss goal, a question that comes in quite common through the podcast and through my social media is, what should I do for fat loss, cardio or weight training? And my answer is always the same. The answer is both, but they work in different reasons. Or apologies, they work in different ways. Cardio works to burn calories, like I said, which can support a deficit. Resistance training, although may not yield as many calories burned per hour, all other things considered and all other things equal, with a comparison to a calorie burning cardio workout, what resistance training does is it increases your metabolic rate. So you burn more calories while you rest. It's what I call in books, you know, burning fat while you watch TV. You do resistance training, you tear down those muscle fibers that we talked about earlier, but as a result, your metabolism elevates, you get an increase in metabolic rate, but your metabolism, for the lack of a better term, it boosts, it increases, and you end up burning more calories while you rest. So weight training and resistance training is the calorie burning equivalent of making money while you sleep. So when you have a fat loss goal, incorporating both of those tools into your plan can be really useful. A resistance plan with an element of cardio. With cardio, then you also want to break down the form. So not all cardio is created equal. So you're comparing different cardiovascular forms. So swimming is cardio, running is cardio, biking is cardio, high intensity interval training, sprints on a treadmill or with a kettlebell is cardio. So what you use, again, reverse engineers you. A good rule of thumb for someone who struggles with cardio or who has the language of I hate cardio, which is very self-limiting in terms of language, so I'd be mindful of using that. But also consider that you can't lump everything together. That's like saying I hate all food or I like all food. It's like there's foods you like and there's foods you don't like. Cardio is the same. You might need to experiment with types of cardio that you enjoy. Yes, you might hate running, but maybe you like to bike ride. Or maybe you hate the bike, but you love five-a-side football or five-a-side basketball. Or maybe you hate five-a-side sports, but you love to get out for a hike at the weekend. All of those things are effectively cardiovascular activities. So you're experimenting and trying to find something in an ideal world, particularly beginners who are struggling with this, find a cardio system that doesn't really feel like cardio. And if you can do that, you're going to have great success with it. I think this is one of the reasons why people who gravitate towards sports tend to stay quite lean. Tennis, even golf to a degree, where you're walking around and on your feet for long periods of the day, although not as active, still active enough compared to sitting on the couch. So you're doing something that can potentially help you burn more calories throughout the day that doesn't necessarily feel like cardiovascular activity. And then look at your low intensity versus your high intensity, which is probably the final argument when it comes to cardio. Some people have a preference for low intensity, steady state cardio, LISS training, which is, you know, cross trainer for 40 minutes or running on a treadmill for 35 minutes versus HIIT training, Tabata. So 20 seconds on a movement, 10 seconds off, 4 minutes total. Or my preference that I have from the Fitness Mindset, that free program that's on the website, BrianKeenFitness.com, is 30-30 on a cardio machine. So 30 seconds on a rower, full out sprint, 30 seconds recover, 10 rounds or 5 rounds if you're a beginner, building up to 10 rounds. And they're all slightly different. So to classify it as a waste of time wouldn't be useful. And the same way as to classify it as cardio, something everybody should do, also probably isn't useful because of the preconceptions that we have to it. So what I'd say here is ask yourself the question and determine if it's a waste of time for you based on what you're looking to do. If you have a muscle building goal, for example, and you're spending an hour, 4 days a week on a cross trainer, yeah, it's a waste of time because you probably should be lifting weights or doing some form of resistance training. So I would argue in that context, it's a waste of time. If you're training for a half marathon, then it's not a waste of time. Running several times a week will help you with that end goal. And the same with body composition. You know, there's a little bit more things to consider with body composition, like I mentioned, in terms of HIIT versus LISS, or are you using it with resistance training and in combination with resistance training to get that body composition change that you're looking to achieve or desire. So think about that as a whole. And as I said, anything that's specific, I've given this advice on the podcast in the past, and I give it on my social media, although I think it gets lost on Instagram a little bit, is anything without context in health and fitness or nutrition needs to be looked at with a critical eye. And anybody that says cardio is a waste of time without context, I would probably take with a pinch of salt. The same way as somebody that says everybody should do endless hours of cardio, I would also take with a pinch of salt. And this is the same for any nutritional advice someone offers. What's the context? You know, all carbs are bad. Like, are you talking simple sugars or complex carbohydrates? What foods are you talking about? You know, you can't demonize an entire macronutrient, or people who say all meat is bad or all plants are bad. You're having that vegan carnivore dispute without context. Well, are you talking from a health perspective? Are you talking from a fitness perspective? Are you talking from an environmental perspective? What's the context of it without just blanket statements? So use a critical eye on that. I think that will help. And I think cardio being a waste of time also falls into that bracket. So there you have it. That's everything from today's podcast. Covered quite a wide range, some new topics, some old ones with a new spin on it. So hopefully you got a lot from it. If you did, be sure to check out some of the other solo Q&As, or if you are a fan of the guest podcast, I've been very fortunate to have some of the world's top performers when it comes to all things nutrition, training, and fitness on the podcast. So have a scroll if you're new to the podcast. If you want more details on anything I've mentioned in today's episode, my books, the Fitness Mindset, Rewire Your Mindset, the Keen Edge, my program, BKF Online program, or any of my courses, the nutrition course, certified course in particular, you can head over to briankeenfitness.com or click the link in the show notes in today's episode. That's all from me from this week's podcast. Get you all next Monday.